Iranians hold nationwide parades on wheels to mark the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Iraq's prime minister says the Iraqi judicial body is following the case of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi commanders. And the Yemeni army says it has hit the airfields of Saudi warplanes at Abha International Airport with several drones. Welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. Iranians have celebrated the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. People in different cities and towns turned out en masse, but in their cars or on motorcycles. They did so to observe social distancing because of the pandemic. In previous years, nationwide rallies were held to celebrate the Islamic Revolution in Iran. The revolution emerged victorious on February 11, 1979. On that day, the Iranian people toppled the monarchical rule of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The revolution was led by the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. He established a new political system based on the principles of Islam.
Iranians from different walks of life have marked the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in a different way this year. More than 6,000 Iranian and some 200 foreign journalists, photographers and cameramen have covered the event. Nationwide rallies were staged by processions of cars, motorcycles and bicycles in the capital city of Tehran and other cities across the country. Millions of Iranians were out on motorcycles, cars and bicycles in the streets and squares all over the country due to coronavirus outbreak to express their support for ideals of the Islamic Revolution. In Tehran, thousands of cars, motorcycles and bicycles converged at Azadi Square, the site of major national rallies over the past four decades. Ballistic missiles of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps IRGC, namely Zulfaqar Basir, Qiyam and Desful, were also put on display as part of the ceremonies at Azadi Square.
I have participated in this special form of rally this year to show my support for the Islamic Revolution and sit down with the U.S., down with Israel.
I am very happy to be here because this is a test for our loyalty to the Islamic Revolution. I know I have passed this test because I am here to voice my support for my leader.
We are here to support our revolution. We take to streets every year, and even coronavirus has not stopped us from celebrating this occasion.
Speaking on the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has hailed the progress the country has made following the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
The late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, relied on people to make the revolution successful. That asset is now threatened by the enemy who seeks to divide the Iranian nation. Such threats can be countered through resistance and unity, and that's what the Iranian people currently have. The country has been under intense pressure in the past several years due to the U.S. economic war, but now everyone admits that the U.S. pressure campaign has failed.
In addition to the annual theme of renewing support for the revolution and Islamic establishment, this year rallies are important since former U.S. President Donald Trump, who vowed he would bring the Iranian nation to its knees, is gone, and the Iranian people are standing stronger than ever before.
This year, ralliers have shouted their protest at the U.S. and its allies for their sanctions against Iran, voicing pleasure at Donald Trump, former U.S. president's failure in his maximum pressure policy against the country. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Political commentator Faraz Ali says the Islamic Revolution was a path to freedom and independence for other countries in the region and beyond.
Yes, the Islamic Revolution was a huge and big happening in the world. Actually, you could say one of the biggest in recent history, because not even the Americans, who had a huge foot and footmark in Iran, were actually expecting it to happen. It happened and surprised them, both their politicians and their think tanks. And the revolution itself, as the late Imam Khomeini said, it exported to the region. So regional countries after the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic groups, the Islamic resistance groups, they came to birth and grow, and the Islamic Revolution actually for the region, but also for other countries like South Africa, managed to be like a path which gives straight forward a way to freedom and independence for a country which for a long time were dependent on the U.S. administrations.
Political commentator Morteza Agha Mohammadi says Imam Khomeini's message of dignity for all Muslims has kept the revolution alive and thriving inside Iran.
This revolution that took place in Iran almost 42 years ago is not something to be sort of national, just to be belonging to Iranians. What makes it sort of international issue, something alive even today, is the message that was there in the movement of Imam al-Khomeini and his people who had this and made this revolution. One more important point to bear in mind is that this revolution took place at a time that there were no choice unless to be whether with the Russian communism or with the American imperialism and liberalism. There were no other choice. When you look at the world, when you look at Africa, other countries, the countries have to be whether with this or that. So Imam Khomeini and the revolution comes to give the message, there was a message of dignity for Muslims from one side, that it was going to give respect to Muslims.
Political commentator Mohammed Abaid says the Islamic Revolution brought many geopolitical changes in the region and led Iran to accomplish a lot of achievements.
The region has been witnessing a lot of changes at the same time at the geopolitical and strategic levels. And in all these levels, the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran has been achieving a lot. You have the continuation of the revolution. First of all, this is one main victory. Here is the importance of the people taking to the streets in order to celebrate. This tells you that the Islamic Revolution is still alive, is still there with a lot of supporters, in spite of all the media campaigns that are being launched by the enemies of the Islamic Republic. So this is an answer to all these campaigns and propaganda. Second, you have the military advances that had been achieved in all these years. Huge steps had been made in this regard, as for the missiles that are really an asset of strength and deterrent of any aggression against the Islamic Republic.
Iran's judiciary chief has called for punishing the perpetrators and masterminds behind the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks while meeting with the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Baghdad. He said the U.S. violated Iraq's sovereignty and territorial integrity by murdering the two anti-terror commanders. Raisi hailed the Iraqi parliament for legislation that called for the expulsion of American troops from the country following the assassination of Soleimani and al-Mohandas. He said that a timetable for implementing the legislation is necessary. Al-Kadhimi, for his part, said the Iraqi judicial body is following the assassination case. The two commanders were killed in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad in January 2020. Iran's foreign minister has reiterated that the Islamic Republic is committed to full justice for the victims of the Ukrainian passenger plane that was unintentionally shut down near Tehran last year. Mohammad Javad Zarif stressed that human error was the cause of the incident. He also dismissed as fake an audio recording which claims the downing of the aircraft could have been intentional. Zarif was referring to the audio recording broadcast by the Canadian media. The plane was shot down near Tehran in January 2020 after Iran's air defense units mistook it with an invading missile. All passengers aboard the airliner died. The Yemeni army says it has targeted Saudi Arabia's Abha International Airport in Asir province with drones. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the drones successfully hit the regime's warplanes' hangar and airfields. He said the strike was carried out by domestically developed UAVs that were accurate in their target. Earlier, the Saudi state media reported that a civilian plane was engulfed in flames in an attack by Yemen's Ansarullah movements on the airport. The Yemeni army has in the past launched a series of such strikes against Saudi positions in response to the kingdom's war on the country. Sana'a says the attacks will continue until Riyadh stops bloodshed. The U.S. is the biggest arms exporter to Saudi Arabia, but the new U.S. administration has recently announced an end to the military and diplomatic support for the kingdom's war in Yemen. The move was received as a sign that other countries would follow suit, but as our correspondent Saeed Purizar reports, one country continues to put the arms industry above all else.
What was called a forgotten crisis has once again become front page news. The brutal war on Yemen, waged by a Saudi-led coalition, aided and abetted by Western powers, in particular the U.S. and the U.K. It's a war that's killed more than 100,000 people, destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, and subjected more than 20 million of its population to famine. But last week, an apparent change in policy, an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, announced by U.S. President Joe Biden, received with cautious optimism for its ambiguous wording. Across the Atlantic, a different reaction from the second leading arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The decision the U.S. takes on matters of arms sales are decisions for the U.S. The U.K. takes its own arms export responsibilities very seriously, and we continue to assess all arms export licenses in accordance with strict licensing criteria. Those campaigning to end the UK weapons exports to Riyadh beg to differ. In 2019, following a case brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, led to a UK court decision banning the sale of UK-made arms to Saudi-led forces over breaches of international humanitarian law. A year later, that ruling was overturned.
Well, they say that all the licenses are double-checked and that actually the weapons that they're selling to Saudi Arabia are not being used in the war on Yemen. This is palpably not the case.
Since the bombing of Yemen began in March 2015, the UK has licensed £6.8 billion worth of arms to the Saudi regime, including more than £2.5 billion in the form of aircraft, helicopters, and drones, and nearly £4 billion in grenades, bombs, missiles, and countermeasures.
I think the figures show just how central Britain is to the ongoing war effort in the Saudi-led coalition. These are huge amounts of offensive weapons that are being sold. And we've even had spokespeople from BAE Systems saying that their involvement, the involvement of this key British company in the war effort, is basically essential to the maintenance of the bombing campaign the Saudis are involved in.
The UK's biggest arms company, BAE Systems, has pocketed £15 billion from services and sales to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began.
An end to arms sales alone may not terminate the war in Yemen, but it could be the beginning of the end. Perhaps it's time for the UK government to put its conscience before its arms industry and prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen from escalating any further. Saeed Purizar, London.
The number of coronavirus deaths in Europe has surpassed the grim milestone of 500,000 as the continent continues to struggle with the disease and its new variants. Russia on Wednesday registered 536 new daily deaths and over 14,000 cases. A total of about 78,000 people have died in Russia from over 4 million confirmed cases since the COVID outbreak. In France, the latest figures show the death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 80,000. The country has also logged over 3.4 million cases, the sixth highest in the world. Elsewhere in Europe, Germany has reported over 8,000 new cases and a further 813 deaths. This as the government is just planning to extend national lockdown until March 14th amid concerns over the spread of the new strains of the coronavirus. The unparalleled economic crisis in the European Union, fueled by the COVID-19 pandemic, will get even worse, the European Commission warns. Many of the bloc's lawmakers claim the Commission's policies have failed millions of EU citizens. Jerome Hughes has more.
The gap between the rich and poor in the EU is growing. Unions accuse employers of using the pandemic as an excuse to cut staff and pay less. A stark economic assessment has been delivered in the European Parliament.
The main social fallout of the COVID-19 crisis is still ahead of us. Unemployment can be expected to further increase, and poverty and inequality are likely to follow the same path.
The blame for this rests with the European Commission, some lawmakers insist.
Your policies are a nightmare. Unfair competition, public services destroyed, mass immigration, greater precarious employment and poverty amongst young people. You think that you can cure the disease that you yourself nurtured.
The economic situation in the EU was wobbly prior to the pandemic. Now things are much worse. Citizens have been sharing their experiences.
I work less, and so I'm one less money too. And the other costs are still here.
The whole situation, the whole viral outbreak, has clearly consequences on all levels, on a social level, on a family level, and also on an economic level.
A €672 billion COVID-19 recovery fund has just been endorsed by EU lawmakers. However, some claim governments in the bloc will squander the money.
The Spanish government has increased the budget for the king and for the army, and has no plans for struggling businesses.
Apparently, to save the EU project from collapse, the 19-nation eurozone must be prioritised by governments.
We've been caught in with disaster for a long time. We have avoided disaster inside the eurozone, but there is no reason to believe that we'll continue doing so forever.
In the EU's richest country, Germany, 8 million workers are on very low pay. EU lawmakers are demanding a minimum wage for the 27-country bloc. The European Commission previously set a target to take 20 million people living in the bloc out of poverty before the end of 2020. That effort failed miserably. Many lawmakers argue the EU is not the solution, it's the problem. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Infections and deaths from coronavirus keeps rising in several countries in the Americas. Mexico on Tuesday reported more than 1,700 new fatalities in just 24 hours. It also confirmed over 10,000 new COVID cases, bringing the country's overall tally to nearly 2 million. Brazil registered more than 51,000 new cases in the same period. It also reported almost 1,400 new deaths. Brazil is the second worst affected nation in the Americas, with more than 9.6 million total cases. The worst hit in the region is the U.S. Its total cases are above 27.1 million. Out of that, nearly 470,000 have been fatal. The U.S. is also the hardest hit nation by the pandemic in the world. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, culture, politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Amid the rush of deportations, four detainees at two different ICE detention centers said that guards threatened to put them in COVID-19 wards, says John Washington Ryder in an article published under the heading ICE threatened to expose asylum seekers to COVID-19 if they did not accept deportation. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Three Cameroonian asylum seekers locked up at the Pine Prairie ICE Processing Center in Louisiana say that a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement guard threatened to expose them to COVID-19 if they failed to obey his orders and submit to a transfer. The guard made the threat clear. Clovis Fozal, one of the detained men, told The Intercept, if the detained migrants didn't submit, they would be transferred to Bravo Alpha, the detention unit where COVID-19 positive detainees are held in quarantine. They were forcing us out of the dorm, pushing and dragging us, Fozal said, explaining the alter action when the guards tried to force them to submit to the deportation. They threatened to call the SWAT team. They said they were going to put all of us into Bravo Alpha, which is for quarantine, where they keep everyone with coronavirus. The Pine Prairie facility, which is operated by the private prison firm GEO Group, currently has 21 confirmed coronavirus cases, according to ICE's own tracker. After the threat of contagion, guards forcefully dragged and pushed a group of Cameroonian asylum seekers, five in total, yelling at them and repeatedly threatening them in an attempt to begin the deportation process, three of the detainees involved told The Intercept. In a statement, ICE said that it takes allegations of misconduct seriously and, when reported, will conduct investigations. Allegations of misconduct by ICE employees or contractors are reported to ICE's Office of Professional Responsibility, OPR, and are reviewed by the Department of Homeland Security, DHS Office of the Inspector General, OIG, and ICE officials said. ICE is firmly committed to the safety and welfare of all those in its custody. All five of the men had spent over a year in detention, said the three asylum seekers after fleeing Cameroon that has been targeting protesters supporting or even adjacent to the Anglophone separatist movement. In recent years, there have been massacres and mass atrocities in Cameroon, what some observers are calling a genocide, sparking increasing numbers to flee in search of safety. Nonetheless, the U.S. grant rate of asylum applications for Cameroonians plummeted over the last year, and as recently last November, Cameroonians were deported en masse. Some of the deported were detained and tortured upon arrival back in the country, according to returned asylum seekers reporters have spoken with. After the threats and the assault, Fozal and the others gave up and submitted to the transfer. What could we do, he said. There were so many more of them than us. The men said that they were crammed into a van with other detainees and taken to a staging center in Alexandria, Louisiana, where migrants are often grouped together before a deportation flight. There, they were again forced into overcrowded conditions where it was impossible to socially distance. There were about 100 people in one room, estimated one of the detainees who spoke with The Intercept on the condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal. after an affidavit submitted by a coalition of immigrant advocacy groups was delivered to the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General, the deportation flight was cancelled, as first reported by The Guardian. The letter lists a host of violent tactics IC officials used to pressure the detainees to submit to their deportation, alleging that they engaged in torture. The threats of exposing detainees to COVID-19 are being reported here for the first time. IC has the utmost confidence in the professionalism of the workforce and their adherence to agency policy, the IC official said in the statement to The Intercept. However, ICE has decided to cancel a February 3rd flight to allow any potential victims or witnesses an opportunity to be interviewed and will conduct an agency review of recent use of the force reports related to individuals on this flight and issue any additional guidance or training as deemed necessary. Two days after taking office, President Joe Biden issued a 100-day deportation moratorium, one of his central campaign promises for immigration policy. The administration committed to review and reset enforcement policies as deportations were on temporary hold. 4 days after it was signed, a judge in Texas granted an injunction on a moratorium based on a lawsuit brought by the state of Texas. Though some expect the injunction to be lifted, ICE wasted no time in ramping back up to its deportation machine. As part of the same rush to continue deportations, Josiel Mendez, a Cuban asylum seeker being held in Etowah County Detention Center in Gadsden, Alabama, said that this week he and a group of other Cuban asylum seekers were also being threatened with exposure to COVID-19 if they didn't sign their deportation orders. Mendez told The Intercept that a ranking official at Etowah, who he called a captain, threatened to expose the group to the virus. "They were threatening to take us to the place where people go who have COVID," said Mendez, referring to the quarantine unit. Mendez himself had previously caught COVID-19 in Etowah, reporting symptoms including lasting shortness of breath, but said it was a relatively light case. He and other detainees balk at the threat. "I can't breathe, and they still don't listen to me," he said. Mendez described the medical conditions and the facility's response to the pandemic as abysmal. This week, he had asked for a new mask for losing his, Mendez said, and was told that they had none. The guard pointed to the empty box and said, "No masks." Mendez said he still struggled to catch his breath sometimes and was shocked at the treatment he and others received. Two of the men held in Pine Prairie who were threatened with COVID-19 exposure were especially vulnerable. Fozao has hypertension, and another of the detainees who requested anonymity for fear of retaliation said he had asthma. The asthmatic detainee told the guard he was at high risk for contracting COVID-19. "They don't care," he told The Intercept. Fozao, who has been detained for 18 months, said that some of the guards had claimed that the coronavirus is fake, it's not real. He added, "The way they manage COVID is very bad. I mean very, very bad." Both Pine Prairie and Etowah have come under fire for their dangerous mismanagement of COVID-19, with detainees in Etowah being punished for asking for a COVID-19 test. "You're going to put me in solitary confinement for this, for talking," Mendez told The Intercept. "But I want people to know, what are they going to do? Kill me? Maybe."
ocean of dua.
أسألك الهدى والتقى والعفاف والغنى.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear listeners, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Rarsi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of The Ocean of Dua. In this version of the program, inshallah, we will discuss the true meaning of prayer and dua, the value of prayer, ways of reaching the Almighty Allah, acceptance, and also benefits of dua. So stay with us. Dear listeners, we were trying to elaborate on the concept of bada. We concluded that this bada is a kind of change in the course of events in the universe and history, but they are all, and these changes are all in accordance with the will and irada of the Almighty Allah. But this does not imply the nullification of the law of causality. And irada of the Almighty Allah, as explained earlier, overrides the law of causality by the law of causality itself. We also learned that this bada is the very thing that the Holy Quran suggests, يَمْحُ اللَّهُ مَا يَشَاءُ وَيُثْبِتُ. This mahw and ithbat, obliteration and affirmation, are the same thing as bada. At the end of the 39th verse of chapter Ra'd, the Holy Quran says, and with him is the mother of the book, وَعِنْدَهُ أُمُّ الْكِتَابِ. This mother of the book is the so-called لَوْحٌ مَحْفُوظ, as the tradition suggests, and bada does not occur in this level. Yet everything is confirmed at this level and nothing changes, but bada and supplication can change something at a lower level, which is كِتَابُ التَّكْوِينِ, or the book of creation. رَبَّنَا آتِنَا فِي الدُّنْيَا حَسَنَةً وَفِي الْآخِرَةِ حَسَنَةً وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ وَقِنَا عَذَابَ النَّارِ. Now that we have come to a clear understanding of the term bada, let's talk about believing in this. Belief in bada comes after the belief in tawheed in importance, because disbelief in bada is tantamount to dissociating the will of the Almighty Allah. It means dissociating the irada of the Almighty Allah from the running of the universe. It means that if you don't believe in bada, you are dismissing his dominance over the course of the universe and society. This means you are giving an upper hand to the law of causality over the will of Allah. And it is just as the Jews believed. وَالَتِ الْيَهُودِ يَدُ اللَّهِ مَغْلُولَةً. The 64th verse of chapter Ma'idah says, and the Jews said, Allah's hand is tied up. But as you previously and already know, the Almighty Allah's will and irada reigns over the law of causality. But how? By the law of causality itself. The correct view which the Holy Quran presents is rather his hands are wide open. بَلْ يَدَهُ مَبْسُوطَتَانِ, the rest of the verse suggests. And there is nothing to delimit his power. There is nothing to delimit his hand. Yet, بَلْ يَدَهُ مَبْسُوطَتَانِ, his hand is stretched out over the universe and society. And this is the first effect of the belief in bada, which is in fact related to one's belief in the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo kashti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedas. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala bas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy will God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah, that we hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God speaks with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Now, the second effect can be seen with respect to one's relation with Allah. Because belief in the open-handedness of Almighty Allah in all situations, in changing and altering what has been necessitated by the cause and effect system, this prompts a person to take resort to Allah in all his needs and affairs. Whenever he feels he needs to resort to something, he will refer to the Almighty Allah. He won't turn his back to his religion. And he won't turn his back on monotheism in action and belief, because he knows that everything that the Almighty Allah wills will happen. And let me make clear one this thing. The most effective way in attracting man to Allah and drawing him to him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, is supplication to Allah for his needs and requirements at times of difficulties. That's why we have been ordered, and it is recommended for us in the narrations, that we should always continue supplication. We should always call for the Almighty Allah's help, not specifically at the times of difficulties. And this makes us believe in the concept of monotheism. Monotheism is something that we should believe in, and also we should act upon. And acting upon this, one of the aspects of acting upon monotheism is that we should continue dua and supplication, even not at the times of difficulties. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. To you through all my life.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Since former President Donald Trump failed to reverse the outcome of the 2020 presidential election, Republicans in more than two dozen states have introduced over 100 bills to restrict voting access, an alarming development that voting rights advocates have pointed to as yet another reason for Democrats to abolish the filibuster, an anti-democratic tool currently allowing the GOP minority to block the enactment of a suite of popular pro-democracy reforms. This was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Downright Scary. In 2021 alone, GOP introduces more than 100 voter suppression bills in 28 states. Here's the details of this article. Since former U.S. President Donald Trump failed to reverse the outcome of 2020 presidential election, Republicans in more than two dozen states have introduced over 100 bills to restrict voting access, an alarming development that voting rights advocates have pointed to as yet another reason for Democrats to abolish the filibuster, an anti-democratic tool currently allowing the GOP minority to block the enactment of a suite of popular pro-democracy reforms. Mother Jones journalist Ari Berman recently reported on GOP's ongoing nationwide push to make voting more difficult, particularly for communities of color and other Democratic-leaning constituencies, and in some cases to empower state legislatures to overturn election results. He called the state-level Republicans' efforts a huge scandal that should be getting as much attention as Trump's plot to overturn the election. Republicans across the country, Berman said, are weaponizing Trump's lies about the fraud in an attempt to roll back voting rights after last year's historic turnout and expansion of mail-in ballots. Democrats have a clear choice, Berman continued. They can get rid of the filibuster to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and for the People Act to stop GOP voter suppression, or they can allow the GOP to undermine democracy for the next decade. The states, Berman added, couldn't be higher. That's because, according to an analysis conducted by the Brennan Center for Justice in late January, Republicans at the state level have introduced three times as many bills to chip away at voting rights compared to the same point last year. Already this year, 106 bills have been introduced in 28 states, including 17 under complete GOP control, where passage is more likely to undermine access to the franchise. According to the Brennan Center's report, these proposals primarily seek to, number one, limit male voting access, number two, impose a stricter voter ID requirements, number three, limit successful pro-voter registration policies, and number four, enable more aggressive voter roll purges. These bills, the report argues, are an unmistakable response to the unfounded and dangerous lies about fraud that followed the 2020 election. And this week, CNN reported lawmakers in the Republican-controlled Georgia Senate added more. They include proposals that would eliminate no-excused absentee voting for many state residents and end automatic voter registration when obtaining a driver's license. According to Berman, the nine bills that Georgia Republicans introduced on February 1st would amount to one of the worst voter suppression laws ever passed. Not to be outdone, Arizona Republicans have since the start of 2021 introduced 34 bills to make voting harder, including reducing the number of polling places in Maricopa County from 100 to 15. Georgia and Arizona are not alone. Similar reactionary proposals are being pushed by Republicans in more than 2 dozen additional states. The spike in anti-democracy bills represents an intensification of an existing trend rather than a new development. As Common Dreams reported last November, Trump ally Senator Lindsey Graham admitted shortly after the election that making voting more accessible hurts the GOP's electoral prospects. If we don't do something about voting by mail, we are going to lose the ability to elect a Republican in this country, Graham told Fox News host Sean Hannity. The GOP has been trying to undercut efforts to expand voting access for years. A decade ago, Berman wrote Republicans passed new voter ID laws and other efforts to curtail voting rights when they took power in the states following former President Barack Obama's election. But now, he added, Republicans are taking their assault on voting rights to the next level. Like the Brennan Center, Berman attributed the surge in anti-democracy legislation to Trump's failed bid to subvert the will of the people in last year's election. According to Berman, the GOP is trying to accomplish through legislation what Trump couldn't with litigation. All in all, these efforts amount to the most concerted attempts to roll back voting rights since the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Meanwhile, at the federal level, Democratic lawmakers are pushing to expand ballot access. CNN reported that the voting bills in Congress, which Democrats have said are an early priority, would establish at least 15 days of early voting in federal elections, allow for automatic voter registration, restore voting rights to former felons, and bar states from prohibiting mailing and curbside voting, along with a slew of other changes to election and campaign finance laws. As Common Dreams reported last month, Democratic leaders have said the For the People Act, a far-reaching package of democracy reforms, is a legislative priority. But GOP opposition to the bill renders passage unlikely unless lawmakers kill the filibuster. The Brennan Center's Wendy Wazer told CNN that you have an absolutely necessary piece of legislation to restore democracy. The filibuster absolutely shouldn't stand in the way of accomplishing it.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kHz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz Uprising of February 18, 1978.
The camp of the enemy, it was not just one enemy. The enemy was a camp, tried as hard as it could. It did whatever it could, from street fighting to ethnic conflicts to military coups to the eight-year imposed war to economic sanctions to starting the impressive machine of psychological warfare over the past 32 years. It is 32 years now that psychological warfare has been going on against the Iranian nation, against the revolution, and against the Imam. They lied, they leveled allegations, they spread rumors, they tried to foment discord, they tried to divert our people from their paths. The primary goal that they were pursuing was to crush the revolution and overthrow the Islamic Republic. The first goal was to overthrow the government. The next goal was to transform the revolution in case they fail in their attempt to overthrow the Islamic Republic. That is to say, the goal was to destroy the nature and the spirit of the revolution, but let it keep its surface form.
Allah, Allah. La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, 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 la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, Allah, Allah.
They made a lot of efforts in this regard. The fitna of the year 1388, according to solar calendar, was the latest scenario that they planned out. In fact, it was another attempt. Some people inside the country fell for this plot because of their passions and the love for power and other such spiritual maladies which are caused by human passions. I have repeatedly pointed out that the designers and the masterminds were and still are outside our borders. Some people cooperated with them inside the country, some knowingly and some unknowingly. This was the second goal. The third goal that they have been pursuing is to make the Islamic Republic use weak and vulnerable elements who can be influenced. That is, if the Islamic Republic stays in power. They want to put such people in charge of the country's affairs and only deal with them.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.